And we're live. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Friendly Ex-Muslim Podcast. I almost said Friendly Muslim Podcast. That would have been bad. This is actually episode number 100. So Susanna is going to have the honor of being number 100.
What?
You're number 100. I can't believe it's 100 episodes now, and that's specifically like interviews. And so, wow, this was like, didn't expect to be doing so many, but yeah. So I've known Susanna for a couple of years now. We've been talking online.
Wait, that's not true.
It was not true.
I've only been doing this for like a year and a half.
Yeah, year and a half.
Does that count like as a couple of years?
Almost two. Yeah. So it feels like a couple of years anyway. So you already got the skeptical fact checking going on right here, right at the beginning of the show. This is good stuff. So welcome, Susanna.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so honored that you have me for episode 100. Like, what an occasion. I wasn't expecting this.
Yeah, no worries. Looks like we have all of the crew in the chat. We got Armin Nawabi, we got Dee,
we
got all Secularity, all you guys, Suha, everyone came to join to support you. This is awesome. Armin saying, why am I not an admin? Dun, dun, dun. Uh-oh. Okay. And also thank you to Zeeshan for joining the channel as well. Appreciate it. Alrighty. So we're going to talk about Susanna. You're an ex-Catholic. So we're going to talk about you. We're going to talk about your journey a little bit. And then we're going to talk about sexual shame, which is an interesting topic, something you've talked about before, something I haven't really explored on this channel. So I think it's an interesting topic for sure. I'd like to know, before we get into that, like, let's talk about your connection to Atheist Republic. What's your title at Atheist Republic, and how did you get involved with Atheist Republic? Why is this important to you? Like, how did you get into this activism? Because apparently you had a life before atheism, and now this, suddenly doing all this stuff.
Believe it or not, yes, like, I did.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. So I became involved with Atheist Republic because around the fall of 2019, I was struggling with a lot of kind of the after effects of leaving religion in my life, and also teaching myself more critical thinking skills in a more structured way. And that led me to pursue a lot of different content online. And so I started watching a lot more atheist content, like the Atheist Experience. But I actually wanted content that was a little bit more diverse, that discussed more different religious ideologies across the world. You know, just because of where the ACA is based, you know, they're going to, in America, you're going to get mostly Christian, ex-Christians or people who are questioning or trying to defend Christianity. And I wanted something different. And I very quickly found Atheist Republic and the ex-Muslim movement at large. And this was just really interesting to me. Like, never been exposed to these ideas. There were so many things I didn't know. So I was just soaking it all up like a sponge, particularly ex-Muslim content. And long story short, I appeared as a guest on the Secular Jihadists for Muslim Enlightenment podcast to talk to Armin and Ali about how they were instrumental in having me leave like the regressive left / like Antifa. Oh, and so if you guys want to hear more about that story, go check out the episode I do with them. And that was the first time I talked to them. And I've been watching Atheist Republic, and one of the things I love the most about what we do is our weekly news show. And we used to have a setup so that we would have a representative from every major faith. And at that time, they didn't have an ex-Christian on the panel. So at the end of our show, I told Armin, I was like, hey, if you ever need an ex-Christian, like, I'm available and I think that'd be fun. And he's like, are you sure? Because like, if you say yes, I'm going to like lock you in for this right now. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And after some time, the previous CEO, she needed to step down to go do things in her personal life. And I guess I was the first person they thought of. And I was elected as the president and CEO of Atheist Republic. So that's like my formal title.
Oh, nice.
And I'm the grand poobah. I do everything.
So you said that it was important to you because of what you were going through, the way that how did it affect your life becoming atheist or leaving religion? Why was religion hurting you in any way in your life? What were the issues there?
So that's a very good question. My relationship with religion has been very different through different periods of my life. So I grew up in a family of a Catholic family, but what was different about my family is that my parents actually converted to Catholicism from a more like kind of generalized Protestant background vaguely to actual Catholicism. And so my family was more into and more had more conviction about their beliefs than a lot of the other Catholic families I grew up around, where for many people it's just kind of a cultural identity. Like my friends who came from like a Filipino or Hispanic background, you know, that's like still very strongly believes, but it's also just more kind of cultural family to background. An extent.
Yeah.
And so they were very into it. And I went to Catholic education for the majority of my schooling. And then around the age of 12, my parents made the decision to move me from the school I had been going to my entire life to an all-girls school, a Catholic all-girls school. And this might sound kind of silly. I mean, it is because I was 12. now as I'm an adult, I actually really like the decision that they made. But at the time, I had a lot of anger and resentment because I felt like they were making this decision without consulting me, without any consideration for how I felt about it. And it made me start to question them. You know, because I'm like, oh, you know, you're doing this without taking into consideration some things that are very important to me.
Yeah.
Like it kind of makes me question other decisions they may have made, including our relationship to religion and God and stuff. So that's when I started to rethink a lot of things and become more skeptical. And then a few years later, when I was around the age of 15, is when I realized that I was bisexual. And anyone who knows anything about Abrahamic faiths know that that's like not really an okay thing. It's not really a cool thing. It definitely wasn't okay in my family. It was like very taboo. I mean, now everyone's like fine with it for the most part, but as a young child, you know, I didn't really have a way to unpack this or talk to anyone about it or find information and just feel like it was okay and normal. And so at that point, I actually kind of made this decision that I was going to leave religion because, well, coupled with the fact by like a year later, I attempted suicide, which is like another big no-no. It's another big no-no. So my thinking was along the lines of like, okay, I have 2 fast track tickets to hell. Okay. I can either buy into this ideology and basically be cognitively crippled by this knowledge or this belief, or I can say, you know, actually, I don't follow this, and hopefully this will allow me some room to thrive more. It's interesting, though, because then throughout my later adolescence and then young adulthood, I realized that I still had very negative opinions about myself and very kind of self-hating, guilty, deeply, deeply shameful feelings about so many aspects of myself, my desires.
Yeah.
And well, at the time I thought, okay, like I'm leaving religion, I don't believe in God, etc. Now I look back and I say, you know, I think I made the decision to not follow God, but that doesn't really mean that I actually didn't believe.
Yeah.
And because I was treating myself as if I was still bad for not following God's rules, I was still believing that about myself, that I was bad for not following these rules that were handed down to me. And it was also coming from an emotional place, right? So then in the fall of 2019, the fall and winter. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because you're going fast. And there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about before we move on, because then you'll be in your 20s and then I have to go back to when you were 12. So first thing I wanted to say was when your parents made a decision without consulting you at the age of 12, even though in the end, now you sort of think it was a good decision, that wasn't right. Because, you know, as a parent myself, I understand that it's good to talk to your kids, good to involve them in the decision-making process, get the thinking on it, because there might be something you missed too, as an adult. Like you might think you know best, and there might be something that you haven't thought of that, you know, from the child's perspective, maybe there's some way, some negotiation room or something like that. Why do you think it was a good decision to go into an all-girls school? Like why was that a good thing for you? Now that you're an adult.
Yeah. Some people might find this kind of controversial, but I think during the middle school years of my life, which for America is between the ages of like 12 to 13 to around, when do you, like maybe 15, I think is when you kind of graduate eighth grade, 14 to 15. Which is kind of universally a horrible time in someone's life. Yeah. Like middle school just sucks no matter what. I think it's really good for me because there's actually a lot of studies about how sex segregated education can be really beneficial for young girls, particularly at that age, because they receive more attention in the classroom, particularly in the realm of science and math. I don't know if this research is outdated, but that's my understanding, is that actually it's extremely beneficial to girls to have sex segregated education. Not because of the religious ideas behind it, you know, which are like girls and boys can't be together, but because actually girls receive the attention that they need, or they wouldn't receive it otherwise much, or they might be undervalued.
Sister, Islam, it says women must be on this side, men must be on this side. You must convert to the beautiful religion of Allah.
Allah wisdom
will bless you. Will the bless hikmah. You. Allah will cover you up. No one will see you like a diamond. But then diamonds, you're supposed to show diamonds. You don't hide diamonds. But anyways, never mind that. You, sister, you will become Muslim. I know it. I feel the iman. I can feel that you will convert soon. Mashallah, sister. Mashallah. So, So that was actually a good thing for you. But picking up a child and taking them out of everything they know and moving them for the wrong reason. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. Yeah. It was for religious reasons, right?
I think they actually did have a genuine interest in my education. I mean, it was also informed by my mom actually went to that same school, and so did her sisters. So it was probably coming from a personal experience as well. But it was also beneficial because, I don't know, maybe this is actually my Catholicism jumping out. during that time, I think, the relationships that girls develop to boys can be really volatile or maybe not good. Like that's when a lot of bullying happens, a lot of body shaming, a lot of, probably ill-advised sexual awakenings happen. Yeah. No, well, the sexual awakening isn't ill-advised, but like maybe some behaviors that aren't necessarily safe or smart because they're kids.
Yep.
That was really good for me because I think it forced me to kind of develop my sense of self without like outside of the relationship to the opposite sex and like potential attractions and stuff. Because then after some time I was at an all-girl school from sixth grade to through ninth grade. And so then I had to, well, I decided I wanted to switch schools finally, and I went to a secular school for the first time. And then I went into my sophomore year of high school, and I was like, I haven't been around boys that like weren't my younger brother for basically 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I don't actually know how to act around boys. And then I thought, I was like, well, why would I act any different around boys? Like, I should just be me, you know? And I think that's something that I, a feeling that I uniquely earned possibly from being in that environment.
Yeah.
Which I think really benefited me. I mean, there's other stuff about Catholic school that sucks, but.
So, you know, the interesting thing is when you're atheist, you can actually choose things for your kids that make sense for the right reasons. For the reason other than dogma. So, you know, in your particular case, your parents had, you know, some reasoning that was other than the religious teachings or whatever, which is good. But it just shows, like, you know, I'm not Muslim, but like, say this sort of setup worked better for my kids. And, you know, I could put my daughter in an all-girls school if there's an option like that available in my area, whatever. I don't need to be a Muslim. You don't have to, you know, take all the bad along with maybe that one thing, you know, Islam got right. You know what I mean? Like, we can pick and choose. And that's a beautiful thing about being free. I mean, that's why we call it free thinking. It's because you can choose for yourself what makes sense. Whereas when you're tied to a dogma, you're always going to be limited. And, you know, sometimes people will ask, well, what's wrong with people being Muslim? Or what's wrong with someone being a, you know, religious or whatever? There's nothing wrong with it, but the problem is, as Armin was saying in an interview that we were having, that it, when you're connected to a dogma, it affects like every decision that you make in your life, or it could potentially. And the more it affects, the more you're going to be living your life based on what might be based on a next life that's not happening, right? So you're changing, you're making all of these sacrifices because what you've been told is, you know, the scale is so much towards the hereafter that you need to put all your energy into this thing that probably will is definitely never coming. You're giving up like real things in order for something that's never going to come, right? And maybe it makes people happier, but then they should know that, you know, do this because it makes you happy, not because you're expecting something in return, because you're not going to get it, right? It's a sort of spiritual compulsion when a woman is told you have to wear hijab or you will be punished. And then she says, well, I chose to wear it. Well, in the back of her mind, she's choosing it because there's some reasoning there, including I will be punished if I don't wear it. If that's her reasoning, which of course it is, either that or cultural or whatever, then it's not really a free choice. It is her choice, and we should respect her choice. I mean, even if it's being influenced by religious dogma, but we can point out that this is actually a bad thing. Hijab is not a good thing, and I don't like it. People, you know, some Muslim women get mad at me for, you know, mansplaining or whatever about hijab, but it affects the women in my life too, right? Like, it affects,
of course,
potentially my daughter. Well, no, my daughter is not going to wear hijab, but but like, it affects other people's daughters and it affects other women in the world too. And, you know, I have a right to talk about it as much as anybody else, as much as a Muslim has a right to say, you know, wear hijab day, try wearing a hijab, you know, and you know, so.
Yeah, I think it's kind of silly to say that, like, you're mansplaining just because you're talking about it as a man, you know. Why should they hold that against you because of your sex or gender? Yeah. But I really like, oh, okay, what you earlier said, like, oh, even if there are some things, or like, Islam got that right. But the thing is, it got it right, so to speak, for the wrong reasons.
Yes.
Right? On the basis of the wrong premises, not because of it could actually improve the quality of education for women, but because there's actually something harmful or dangerous about being around women and how they can lead you astray, right?
Well, I don't know if Islam says like that. Islam doesn't say that women are like, I think with Islam it's more that it goes both ways. So if the woman can be a temptation, but the man can also be a temptation for the woman. So it's like both directions. It's a sort of unilateral temptation, right? Because it's not although there are hadith with a pretty misogynistic that say things like, you know, when a woman wears perfume, she's like a prostitute, and when a woman is attractive, shaitan sits on her head. So it does kind of put the burden on the woman, right? But in the Quran, it doesn't really. I think it's more, I don't want to say it's equal, because for sure it's more on the woman for sure. But like in terms of what I was taught as a Muslim, it's, you know, I didn't shake hands with women because, not because a woman was, you know, like dirty or unclean or something inferior. No, I didn't shake hands with her, and she wouldn't shake hands, and my wife wouldn't shake hands with other men either. It was kind of like a two-way thing, just mm-hmm. to kind of try to be a little bit fair. But yeah, of course, there's a lot of misogyny, not just there, but in the culture, and then the honor killings, and then, and we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about sexual shame, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was just trying to like speak to that general attitude, and obviously that isn't exclusive to Islam either.
Yes.
And you're right, it does go both ways, but like it manifests unequally for women.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when it comes to like stoning for adultery, or like the capital punishment kind of laws for premarital sex. For some reason, it always ends up that the woman is the one that ends up getting punished. I mean, we see that all the time. There's a woman being stoned. Like, you rarely ever hear about the man being stoned, right? Like, or in was it Indonesia or Malaysia? Indonesia, I think they were like, you know, caning a lady for premarital sex.
It's in somehow Indonesia. We've reported on them caning men for premarital sex too. And oftentimes gay men.
Oh.
Or okay. Allegedly gay men. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely the rule applies to both, but it does tend to be that the women are the ones who get the unfair shift. And there is actually an asymmetry in Islam, where a woman that accuses a man of something can be also charged if she doesn't come up with four witnesses, right? So there's mm-hmm. an asymmetry there, because Muhammad wanted Aisha to be innocent. So he said, if you accuse her of adultery, of cheating on me, you need to get four witnesses or you will be whipped. But the problem is, this became a rule that now made it difficult for rape victims, because now mm-hmm. you can't bring up that you were sexually molested, because now you need four witnesses. Otherwise, you're the one that's making a false accusation against an innocent man, right? So it becomes difficult for, because again, it's usually women that are victims of sexual assault, not men. So if it was a man, technically the same issue would happen, but it's less likely to happen in real life just because of the differences between men and women or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's
the Jehovah's Witnesses do the same thing, interestingly enough. Except for Jehovah's Witnesses, they have to produce two witnesses.
Oh, no way. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
And this is a huge problem when it regards to systemic child abuse within the organization. Because how rarely are there two witnesses when the child's being abused, you know? Yeah. You don't do that in front of other people. True. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem.
So I wanted to ask you one more thing, which is, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about it or not, but you said you tried to commit suicide at 15. Is this something that's worth talking about there? What happened or why it happened? Was it just personal reasons or difficult? So was it connected to the religion in any way?
I don't think directly. I think to a certain extent, the expectations that were put upon me by religion, I think, did influence the generalized feeling of this like unbearable shame. Pressure and expectation mm-hmm. that I couldn't maintain or live up to, because mm-hmm. I mean, I was just severely mentally ill, you know. Okay. And I took medication for it, and that went a long way, because, you know, at a certain point, if your brain is literally just chemically out of balance, you know, you're very limited in what you can even do. So a lot of it like was that. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, like during that period of time, I think it was around 2011, there was kind of a mini spate or epidemic of LGBT kids like successfully committing suicide. And so a lot of people like assumed that it was because of that. But it wasn't directly because of that for me. I mean, the specific reasons of what it happened that night, like, are not actually interesting to get into. Interestingly enough, I think it's one of like the best things that ever happened to me.
How is that?
Very quickly after it happened, I realized that I actually didn't want to die.
Oh, wow.
I realized that what I actually wanted was relief from what I described as just a blue hell in my head. You know, it's like, I don't actually want to die. I just want relief. And I thought that that was the only way to get it. And then I was like, oh no. and in general, that whole experience, made me an extremely compassionate person that has, a real passion for others and empathy. And I think, a certain level of understanding of what that kind of experience is like that maybe a lot of people don't understand. Like, you know, a lot of people, maybe who have had family members, commit suicide or, you know, go through really severe stuff. Sometimes people frame it as like, that's selfish. That's a selfish thing to do. And I understand where they're coming from. Because that obviously affects their life very deeply as someone, you know, who's close to people who go through stuff like this. But, being on the other side of it, I understand that, there isn't, when you're in that mind frame, that like isn't even part of your calculation. Like it's literally your brain grasping at straws, thinking that that's the only option available to you.
You've lost all coping mechanisms. You don't have any coping mechanisms. You're just like, you don't, there's no,
Yeah. And it's kind of funny when I talk about it, and I understand why people think that it's a very like dramatic, traumatic thing. And I, to me, it's just kind of like normal at this point. It's like, oh yeah, that's something that happened to me. So I don't really have any qualms or uncomfortability about talking about it. Because I mean, I'm still here, right?
Yeah, you came to peace with it. And I'm glad that you didn't do that. I mean, didn't succeed. That's great. It's always good to hear from survivors. So you were, I interrupted you. You were getting to what happened next.
Oh, that's right. So coming back more towards the present and my evolving relationship with religion, so around 2019 is when I was struggling extremely deeply with a lot of stuff that was, kind of the leftovers from religion in my life. And for people who have left religion, oftentimes, I think we kind of sometimes share a frustrating experience where logically you know that a lot of what you learned from your religious upbringing or background is not logical. It's not sensical. It's not reflected in data or, you know, or the reasons why you believe those things aren't rational, but you still have an emotional hangup over it, right? And that's a lot harder to work through because you can sit there and be like, I know that what I'm feeling isn't based in reality, but I still feel this way. And I feel stuck that way. So for me, during that period of time, one thing I was just struggling with so deeply was a lot of extremely severe shame, which is extremely Catholic. I don't know. I feel like this might be a generalization. People from other religious backgrounds don't struggle with shame the way that a lot of former Catholics do.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
And I think part of it has to, and this is a generalized Christian thing, but part of it has to do with the conception of original sin. Like when I learned that Islam didn't have, original sin, I was like, what?
Are you serious? That's, wow, that's interesting. So how did it affect you, this idea of original sin?
Because it teaches you that to a certain extent, you are bad and you were bad and you always will be bad. Like you're born into sin. And you have to prove for the rest of your life that you're worthy of salvation, which is a really hard thing for like a child to deal with, right? Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that which I left religion or didn't follow God's rules, it just felt like further and further verification of that I was bad, you know, and that I deserve to feel badly about myself and think and feel and believe bad things about myself, because it kind of it validates that teaching. For me, a lot of my shame was centered around sexuality in particular. I really needed some ways. I needed to shake up the ways that I thought about these things and try to get some outside perspective. So I started studying, cult psychology, actually, and, the destructive, coercive, undue influence and how that works on people, because my background is psychology. And, so that really helped me put into perspective, different ways that I was taught, different ways that ideas were enforced in me throughout my life. And it made me question a ton of other things that I believed, coincidentally. I think there might be a formal name for this, but I think it was Pascal who gave this analogy of a rotten barrel of apples, meaning like all your beliefs and all your ideas and ideologies that you've bought into. And it's kind of this visualization of taking all this barrel of apples, and you know that some of them are rotten, but you're not going to be able to figure out which one is rotten until you pour the barrel out on the floor and sort through to find which are rotten. And so I was like, okay, well, to be, you know, a good critical thinker, you know, I think I'm pretty smart. I think I believe what I believe is justified. So I kind of was like, okay, well, I'll kind of do this exercise for fun and start more individually going back and verifying what I believe. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of dumb shit that I realized I believed.
Oh, wow. So where did you hear about this? Was it a book you read, or like, how did this journey happen?
Wait, where is it? Yes, right here. So this is a fantastic book I recommend to everyone who is interested in understanding destructive belief systems or how cults work, actually. But it kind of is just like good at teaching critical thinking and identifying destructive influence in general. So it's called Combating Cult Mind Control by now he's a doctor, Dr. Stephen Hassan. It's spelled Hassan, but it's pronounced Hassan. And he's basically America's number one cult expert. And he's actually a cult survivor himself, and a labor trafficking survivor. He draws upon his experience and then also what he's learned in decades of helping to counsel other people out of destructive cults. And so that's kind of where I like learned a new way of identifying bad stuff and looking at critical thinking in a new light. And so that made me question a lot of like political ideologies that I had bought into, which was very good. And it also made me think about religion in a new way. And in this book, he talks a lot about always seeking out criticism. So a destructive group will discourage you from seeking out criticism. They might even take measures to control the information that you can consume.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. And so I started seeking out information, and I would look up debates between people of different ideologies. So obviously, if you watch The Atheist Experience, that's a very easy way to find people debating atheists. And then I was like, well, and then he specifically mentions to go seek out former members of a group before buying into like something new, because they will probably have a more informed criticism than other people. And I was like, okay, well, let's look at other religions. And so that's how I started looking for ex-Muslims. And that's kind of how I studied. I stumbled across the ex-Muslim movement and stuff. And that just like shifted everything for me. That shook up everything.
Nice. Before we continue, I just want to, there's a couple of comments I want to highlight, which are kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And I do want to share one more thing. I'm just going to share my screen here. So those of you watching and on the stream, please like the stream right now and give it a thumbs up. And if you're feeling generous, you can even join the channel as a channel member and you get a cool little icon next to you and special color in the chat and stuff like that.
Do it. Support Abdullah. He deserves it.
Thank you. Thank you. So that's a good place to just pause. And I do want to read some of the comments. And I want you to actually do your plug as well for the stuff that you're doing. But before we do that, let me just read a comment. And then we will get to that, which is Hasib says, whereas Islam doesn't explicitly teach original sin, the rhetoric of Islam treats everyone as sinful, embodies the submission of Islam in a sense, probably a mindset inherited from Christianity. That's interesting. Yeah, it's with Islam. It's like you sometimes hear Christians say this thing where, oh, but you can't guarantee me you're going to heaven. They say that to Muslims. I remember hearing this as a Muslim, but because in Islam, like, you can never be religious enough. Like, you are taught, no matter how pious you are, unless you're, I don't want to say suicide bomber, unless you're a jihadi that goes and dies for the sake of Allah, you are not religious enough. You can never be religious enough, no matter what you do. And if you think you are religious enough, you're a hypocrite. You're not a hypocrite, like in the English sense of the term, but you're a munafiq. Mm-hmm, you're someone that thinks they're like, because you can't, you're not allowed to think you're a good Muslim. Because if you're a good Muslim, that means that you think that, you know, basically it's just not allowed. That sort of thinking is not considered cool. The best Muslims all think they're bad Muslims, despite the fact that they're more religious than 98% of the world's population, right? Like, they're like next level.
Well, they can religious. Always be better.
Yeah, it's like you can never be good enough as a Muslim. That's like, so it's not really original sin, but yeah, his point is valid that this submission thing, it's just like, you can never do enough, right? It's like, I met one guy that, you know, he told me, even if he saw, like, this is when I was now pretty much atheist at the time, or like about to be, before my channel came out or anything. And he was like, we're talking about it, and we're talking about evidence, and I was talking about lack of evidence. And he said, listen, even if I saw Allah, like literally saw Allah, I wouldn't change my faith right now. That's how much I believe. And I was like, trying to understand, like, here I have issues with the religion. He's just like, okay, kind of like, yeah, not a big deal. And then he's like, I don't even like, so then at that point I realized that there's people out there that they don't care about evidence. They just don't, it's just, but anyways, I'm kind of ranting now.
I get what you mean.
Yeah. So if you want to just, do you want to share the stuff you're doing at Atheist Republic and the blasphemous art and all that stuff? I'll bring it up on the screen too, so we can talk about that a bit.
Oh yeah. Well, what was I going to say? Something about sex shame.
Original sin?
Yeah. It's, really difficult to like move past feeling like, this shame that just feels like it's like part of your sense of self. Right. Like, especially, I think something young women struggle with in particular, like just feeling just utter shame for your desires. Like, I felt so ashamed for having desires at all, like not even specifically like for another woman, just in general. Mm-hmm. And in particularly when you come from a more strongly religious background, the idea of being desirable was extremely shameful to me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because especially like in Catholic school, you know, they're so strict about what you wear and with just kind of like this underlying tone of like slut shaming. And to the point that I went through a period of time where like I questioned my gender and I thought I was trans but I don't feel that way now. And I think it was literally because I was so trying to bury and suppress so many parts of myself that I just didn't even want to be a woman because it felt so shameful to be a woman and feel the way I do. So I was like, it's just better to be a man because it's just, it's so, it just felt so dirty, I guess, to be a woman with a sexuality. I didn't even want people to see me that way. Like I dress completely differently than I, how I do now because I wanted to just cover every part of my body. Like I would dress in extremely loose clothing. You couldn't see any shape of my form. I dress like a guy most of the time. And I mean, I do kind of like that style. I'm from Seattle. So like grungy style is just kind of how we dress. But it was more like shameful and like trying to make myself not seem attractive, like kind of actively, because that was scary to me. And I felt like I needed to protect myself from that, from people desiring me, because it's wrong, right? Like it's, there's so many things in the Bible about how you inspiring lusted men is horrible, or Jesus says, you know, like pluck out your eyes if it causes you to lust or be in temptation and stuff. And it's taken me a really long time to get past that. It literally wasn't until like last year that I started to feel comfortable wearing shorts. And I'm not even from a fundamentalist family.
Wow, sister, I told you, you would make a good Muslim. You have all of the right things in place. Next thing you know, it's funny because I think there's people like you that instead of ending up atheist, end up Muslim, including potentially like, actually, I'm not going to mention, including people I know that, well, I know like a woman that became Muslim and potentially this makes sense because hijab appealed to her and stuff like that. A lot of what you're saying actually, so the interesting thing about Islam is, other than like, you know, the shame thing, I think is very different in Islam. And I think Islam Muslims are proud of this because this is actually one of the characteristics of the religion. It's actually mentioned that, you know, the Quran says Jesus was not a monk and Muhammad made it like part of the religion to get married. Like you need to like enjoy your sexuality in context of marriage, which I know is part of Christianity too, but it's like, it's different because sex is not shameful in Islam. Yes, you're not supposed to go around attracting men and you're supposed to cover up and hide your beauty. And, you know, to the extent that some women wear niqab and, you know, you have people like Ninja Mommy that will go around saying Islam has dress code for men too. And it's like, I don't know what she's talking about because the dress code for men is nothing. Basically, it's like you have to cover from your navel. It's like literally from your navel to your knee. That's the dress code for men. That's the minimum. It doesn't mean you're supposed to go around like that, but like that's the aura. The aura is like the minimum, like what you have to cover. Whereas for a woman, it's everything. It's like everything has to be covered. And some women would consider, I know this is not a common opinion, some Muslims consider the voice of a woman is aura. Well, if you think about it, in Islam, a woman's not allowed to lead the prayer in front of men. A woman's not, I mean, things are kind of changing a bit, but I've never, as a Muslim, even pretty much almost once in my life, ever heard a woman reading Quran other than like a family member, like my auntie or my mom. Women don't read Quran for men. When I saw on YouTube women reading Quran, I'm like, whoa, women read Quran. This is a thing. I've never seen this before. And they're putting on YouTube, which means, and you probably, if you look at the comments, there'll be lots of comments about men should. But like, I don't know if there's even a rule like that, that a woman's voice is like, there's some reasoning why they're thinking like that. Maybe it's become part of the culture. And of course, even the setup in the mosque and everything is segregated. The women are behind and all that, or even hidden. You know, the Prophet's mosque had no barrier, but now you have barriers and things have changed too in some ways. Some mosques, some sects have become more fundamentalist and some have become more progressive, right? So there's a change. But it's interesting how different Islam is in regard to that being proud of like sex being a good thing. It's actually a part of Islam that it's actually one of the selling points that we're cool with this. We talk about sex and this is okay, even though again in reality I think there's a lot of problems, especially with the gender segregation, especially with the fact there's no dating allowed. Marriage has become incredibly difficult. It's gone in a very toxic direction, right? It's just Midge is actually like a very difficult thing to implement, and then it creates all these other problems. Now you have a lot, like, if you just date, you can date someone and break up with them and then find someone else that's more suitable. But in Islam, you're divorcing that woman now. Now you have to go through a divorce, and now you've just complicated everything so much more. Or you're stuck in a bad marriage and you have kids now because it's your wife and you know you're planning to be forever. So I think it creates a lot more problems as well at the same time, as you know. But it's interesting how from Christianity, there's, like, I've heard this a lot, there's this shame aspect that's such a big thing in Christianity. So it's really interesting. And of course, Muslim men do feel shame too, because a lot of Muslim men will be watching pornography. We can't get it, not allowed to have a girlfriend. So that's obviously that's what they do. But like, there's a lot of shame there, right? And I'd say even for me as a young Muslim man, that's why I got married at 21. Like, I wanted to be in a relationship.
Damn.
And that was the only way I could be in a relationship, was to get married. That's the only mm-hmm. option. I mean, that's the only halal option, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't for my family. It wasn't my parents. My dad and mom dated, right? They didn't have an arranged marriage. They had a love marriage, so-called love marriage. My dad even told me, why don't you guys live together? Don't get married. I'm like, no, I can't do that. He's like, if you like her, just live with her. I'm like, no, I can't. I'm not allowed to do that, right? But anyways, that would have been probably, I think that would have been a better option. But obviously that option wasn't available for me at the time. So yeah, religion just creates a lot of unnecessary problems. In the case of Christianity, it creates the problem of original sin and then it solves it. Here you go, solution. Accept Jesus. But like, what I don't get is, why would you feel shamed about original sin when you're Christian and it's also forgiven because you accepted Jesus died for your sin? So isn't it just like a check mark that you're just checking off? Like, yeah, I'm forgiven.
I mean, I guess, but there's a difference between just like accepting Jesus and actually like being a good or better Christian, right? Like, you actually should be attempting to embody, you know, the message he brought to us to a certain extent. You know, it's in the, with the acknowledgement that you're going to fail and that we're all sinners. And in that sense, it's like egalitarian. You're still left with the knowledge that you're still bad and you're always going to be bad. And that's actually a really horrible teaching for a lot of different reasons, because it completely flattens the severity of different harmful things that we can do to each other. And very much, what's the word I'm looking for? It lessens and diminishes a lot of harm that people do to others, because they're like, well, I'm a bad person. I always will be a bad person because I was born a sinner. I always will be a sinner. And so are you, you know? Yeah, like abusing you is, you know, equivalent to, I don't know, you having sex before marriage.
You know, that's very interesting. I never heard anyone say it like that before. It like flattens the hierarchy of, how did you say it?
Harm.
Of harm. So can you explain that a little bit more? What do you mean by that?
I mean, literally within theology, you know, doing horrible things to kids is, you'll still get into heaven if you accept Jesus Christ in your heart. Like, to this, just the same as like someone who the only bad thing they did was like steal candy from a candy store when they were a child. They're equivalent. They're the same. So
I like that. That's really, really interesting.
In some ways, you know, it's supposed to make things more egalitarian. You know, like a king is just as much of a sinner as a peasant and the same before the eyes of God. But in terms of how that informs how we treat each other, it's not a good model.
You know, that's interesting, because even with Islam, you have the same issue that there is a hierarchy of sins, but the hierarchy is all messed up. So like the top sin is shirk with Allah, which mm-hmm. is associating partners with Allah. That's the only sin that's not forgiven. Every other sin is forgivable. So a Muslim man that is the worst possible human being that ever existed, like according to the Quran, Pharaoh was the worst of all people. If he was Muslim, he would still be better than the best kafir in terms of Allah's sight of him, because the best kafir, you know, people use the example of Gandhi or Mother Teresa. I don't like using those examples because they're like problematic, but even if I say Bill Gates, people will be like, Bill Gates, you know, he's trying to like do all these like crazy things, microchip or whatever. I don't know. Who's a archetypical like pure person? I can't think of an example. And no one's totally pure, but Jesus, I don't know. Anyways, whoever that person is, that person would still go to hell as a Muslim. Okay, a good example would be like the uncle of Muhammad, Abu Talib. Abu Talib was one of the best people. Yes,
he was so good to him.
Yes, he was so good to him. He took care of him. He protected him. All that stuff. And he, according to Sunni Islam, he still goes to hell. According to my friend Armin, ex-Shia, he'd probably be like, how dare you say that? Abu Talib is Muslim.
I have a secret. I watch a lot of Shia content in my free time. Like I study Shiism. So I was watching Majlis by Dr. Omar Syed Naqshbandi. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite lecturers. He's awesome. I completely disagree with him on a lot of stuff, but mm-hmm. he's just a very compelling speaker. And he gave a very passionate speech about how Abu Talib is definitely in Jannah. Like, he's in heaven. I don't care what anyone says. Like, how dare you? And he had proofs for it because, like, when he was responsible for or initiating or commemorating Khadijah's marriage to Muhammad, like, he does so in the name of Allah or something. Like, he's acknowledging. So therefore, he's a Muslim.
The reason they're doing that is because Abu Talib is the father of Ali. Ali is the, you know what I mean? Like, how could, but the funny thing is that Sunnis believe Muhammad's parents are in hell because Muhammad said that. Mm-hmm. My parents are in hell. Have you read Leslie Hazelton's After the Prophet?
I haven't.
Her book is beautiful. After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia Sunni split in Islam. She's great. It's like a novel. It's like you're reading a novel. It's not like reading an academic paper on Muhammad or something. And she kind of like praises Ali, I think, a little bit too much, makes him sound like this idealist role model. Of course, Ali did like he burned people alive. Okay, he's not some like idealist Gandhi type figure or something, right? He's
you don't Ali. Understand what he but, did for our prophet.
But
like, how dare you?
In terms of his idealism, I mean, it's a beautiful book. I would just highly recommend you read it.
Yeah, it's a running joke on our channel at Atheist Republic that I'm a secret Shia, or maybe just an out. I'm an uncloseted Shia.
Well, you got the black thing going, and Shias, don't Shias wear a lot of black and they beat themselves? Oh,
especially
and
during Muharram. Yes.
Yeah. So, anyways, so let's continue on the journey. So, did we finish that now? Like the shame, you know. So that's good. You've explained now. You've made me understand how or why this is important to you, and how religion affected you, how it hurt you. And these are the type of stories that you know people need to know. Not everybody goes through the same thing, but like this is the type of effect that religion can have on people, right? I mean, I had a different experience. You had a different experience. We all had different experience.
Yeah, I think it's important for me to talk about because when I was going through a really tough time, like I didn't find a lot of content that I felt really spoke to what I was going through online that made me feel like there was people that went through what I went through or like that kind of unpacked like how to kind of get through it or recover from it. Like, so that's kind of why I like to talk about it. It was an extremely isolating experience and I still struggle with it, frequently. In what was so hard was that it just made me feel broken. It just made me feel so broken because I would try to talk to it with my friends. And I have a lot of friends that didn't have like a real religious background and I'm so freaking jealous of them. And, or friends who did have a religious background, but they didn't have the same struggles that I went through. And they would literally say to me like, what's the big deal? Just like get over it. Like just move on. And it's not that easy. And that made me feel so, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, kind of deficient, or just so much unlike anyone around me, because no one else was struggling with what I was struggling with. It just made me feel broken in comparison. I was like, why do they get to have, why can they move on so easily? Why is it so easy for them? Why can't I just move on and get over it like they did? Whereas like me going out and just trying to like satisfy my desires will literally send me into a tailspin of self-loathing that I can't get out of for months, you know, until I just like become like actually like a hermit, where I just can't even extend myself to other people because of how deeply I feel ashamed. I wrote, oh my God, like journals about how I felt like if people knew what I thought about and desired, like that I should be executed for it. Like, because I was so deeply ashamed, or that if someone got to know me, that it was only like a matter of time before they would learn something about me and reject me for it. So I didn't even like really trust or believe in the friendships or relationships that I did have, because I thought there was going to be conditions to it, or like a ticking time bomb before they would learn the stuff about me that I thought was just so deeply shameful and just like ditch. If there are other people who are struggling with this kind of thing, I think what helped me a lot was having an excellent therapist, which is something that's really privileged and like not available for people everywhere, either because of expense or because maybe in your country there like literally aren't therapists who you could talk to openly about this kind of thing. And besides that, I think having a really good friend who is like a real positive source of reinforcement and refuses to let you engage with that self-hatred or that shame, or call it out and call it what it is and help you identify it so you can be check yourself on it, is so important. Maybe you can find a couple people in your life like that. Like literally, I wouldn't be where I am today, and I wouldn't be as healthy if I didn't have Armin in my life, I swear. Like, oh my God, I need that friendship in my life so badly. Because I wouldn't even, you know, when this is just so deep in you, you don't even catch yourself thinking this way. You need someone to be like, actually, no, hold up. Like, where are you getting that idea from? You know, that's not true. I think that's really important.
I was going to say, I like what you said about, you know, how you were in a sense jealous of people that were less religious and didn't have as much. So I see this all the time too. You know, and I see exactly what you said from an ex-Muslim perspective, from an ex-Muslim experience. Non-religious Muslims telling me, what's the big deal? Like, why are you?
It drives me insane. I find it so insulting.
They don't, like, first of all, as an ex-fundamentalist, like, I never understood people like that in the first place. Okay, you believe in God. You believe in Allah.
Who are you to talk anyways?
And you're not praying or you're not doing any of this stuff. Like, you're kind of like a fake Muslim already, okay? But they're Muslim, fine. You're a Muslim, whatever. I accept you still believe. I think you believe, because you don't show that you believe. You're not making those sacrifices. So anyways, I'm already like judging these people. And then now I left Islam. I was thinking they'll be like, welcome to, you know, whatever. But they'll know. They were like, it was the opposite. It was like, what's wrong with you? Why are you leaving this beautiful religion? Like, mm-hmm. And they're like, you know, I'm not saying they're drinking alcohol. I wasn't with that less religious people, but like, they don't care about Islam as far as I can tell. Like, they didn't make any of the sacrifices that I made. They didn't, they're like nominal Muslims, like judging me for leaving Islam. And I'm like, oh, you guys don't get it. Like, And then, of course, if you try to talk to them about Islam, they don't know anything about Islam to talk about. They're just like, it's all over their head. They're like, go talk to the imam. Like, they've outsourced their thinking to the imam. The imam doesn't anything. The imam doesn't know. The imam doesn't know about Dholka, Nain, and Alex. Like, he doesn't know these issues. Like, he doesn't know anything. Like, so these guys, they don't think. They're just accepting the imam knows the answers to some issues that some random person's bringing up. They're probably not actually issues. But, like, they're so judgmental. But, like, some people, the more religious you are, the more harm is being caused to your life, which is why I think one of my goals has always been not necessarily to deconvert people, but at least to, like, give them a little bit of doubt. You know, make people, like, let them question, like, maybe I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is not true. And then, like, I have a friend. It's probably like on the way to becoming ex-Muslim. I've been talking to for multiple years, Salafi. And at one point he actually bought a house, a haram mortgage. And this is a Salafi. So this is like completely forbidden. Buying a house on mortgage is like worse than zina. It's worse than adultery. So he can go and cheat on his wife, and that would be less bad than buying a mortgage, right? But I asked him, I said, why did you do that? And he's like, well, you know, what if I'm wrong? And I'm like, yes. What if you're wrong? Like, okay, start making some decisions that are better for your family, that are better for your, because that was the reason. It was for his daughter. Like, the having the daughter was, and you know, I'm sorry that you had to go through all that. I fortunately didn't have to go through that. I left Islam and I was like, okay, there's no God. I have friends just like you that for multiple years they were struggling with. Even like ex-Muslim friends that are ex-Muslim, they've accepted that Islam is false. They still had problems like coming to terms with the reality without God, coming to terms with the fact that, you know, we're alone in the universe. They read some book by, you know, Dawkins, and they were convinced that Islam is false. My job and our job, I think, is to help these people to stay where they are because they're in the right place. You know, I'd say 10 years ago, a lot of people left Islam would have come back to Islam because there wasn't the support systems in place, and it's just easier to go back to Islam because everything is like, imagine you have some doubt in your mind that Islam is true or whatever religion it is, but everyone around you is Muslim. You can't, even if you talk to them, they gaslight you sometimes. Sometimes they don't gaslight you. Sometimes they'll come up with actual responses to things and you're just like, okay, maybe I'm just crazy. Right. And then you start thinking that, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe Islam is true. It might as well just be Muslim. And then they'll become religious again. And that's, I don't want people to have to think that they can't, you know, be themselves. They can't disbelieve because that they're wrong about that. Whereas there's good reasons to disbelieve, right? There's good reasons to live your only life that you have the way you want to live, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's so true, Abdullah. Like what I always say is I'm not trying to tell people what to think. I want to teach people more about how to think. And I think if more people think of, like, cause I'm not an authoritarian, I despise it. I think if more people are taught how to think more strongly, more strenuously, a lot more people will just over time come to my position. Maybe obviously that's a little bias on my part. But it's interesting you bring that up because, well, you know, ex-Muslims of North America has the hashtag awesome without Allah. And every year when they, you know, do that hashtag bomb, Armin Navabi, our founder at Atheist Republic, always says, like, I can only be awesome without Allah because I have the community of ex-Muslims, because that's so important to people. In the sense of belongingness is one of the most important psychological factors towards our own well-being and our own sense of self. Like lacking a sense of belongingness and feeling a sense of burdensomeness are actually two of the highest contributing factors towards suicidality. So having a sense of community is really important, which gives me an opportunity to plug Atheist Republic, because we have so many online communities specifically for people. And the benefit of it being online is that makes it more accessible to a lot of people who it's not safe to go find it actually in person. So if you go to atheistrepublic.com/consulates, you can find at the very top They're drop-down menus of all the different categories. There's international groups, and you can join our international group, which has like over 80,000 people. Oh, there we go. Yeah, see, if you click on international groups, it'll drop down. There we go. So you can find our Facebook page and our main private group where it's screened. So, you know, your safety and identity is, we make sure to consider that when accepting people into the group. And we also have a dating community, by the way, guys. And then if you scroll further down, you'll see that we have actual local groups. We have over 150 consulates in, I think, 72 countries around the world. So then it is an option to people to actually go from the virtual to in person, because for some people that actually is very important for them to feel a sense of community. There was something else you said that I really wanted to touch on. Yes. So when I was talking about earlier, like the stages of my relationship to religion, you know, I said when I first kind of left religion around the age of 15, upon reflection, I now think that I decided to just not follow God, but I was still treating myself as if those rules were valid and I was therefore bad for not following them. And I left for emotional reasons, right? Because I was a queer, sad kid. And it wasn't until I started around late 2019 actually looking at atheist content that handles the God question from a rational and logical perspective that completely shifted my way of thinking. So actually looking at arguments for God, looking at logical fallacies, looking at debates and thinking about it more from a rational standpoint totally shifted the way I thought about things and therefore the way I thought about myself. Because instead of saying, oh, I'm going to leave religion because these rules hate me and I can't buy into and cognitively thrive in that environment, it then changed the question to, actually, does this even exist in the first place? And if the conclusion I come to is no, then my relationship to these rules that I was judging myself by completely shifts, because now they're completely invalid in a totally different lens. I would encourage people who are maybe struggling with some of the stuff that I went through to maybe think about things that way. For example, a quote from Matt Dillahunty that was roughly something along the lines of like, how often do you spend time thinking about or fearing hell from a religion that you didn't grow up in? Which sounds like a very simple statement, but that was mind-blowing to me. I literally wrote it down and I would keep it on my wall, or I would put it in my phone because I needed to refer back to it just to remind myself of like my frame of mind and the way I was approaching the subject altogether. Which actually gives me another good plug. Hey, for Armin Navabi's book, Why There Is No God, where there's 20 common arguments for God, and then like why they don't actually make logical sense. This helped me a lot. And if you subscribe to our newsletter, atheistrepublic.com/newsletter, you get the copy of that book for free, a PDF. Ooh. So that's available to you guys.
Nice. Okay. So I was going to say a couple of things. One thing I wanted to say is, I want to share this on my screen. Hold on. Share screen. We didn't talk about this yet. Let's talk about this.
Hey. So the Blasphemous Art Project. Yes.
So why is this important? How is it connect? How are you connected to this? And yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah, so if you guys saw the episode with Armin, our founder, last week, then you already heard about this and kind of the origin, but I'll give like a brief summary. So last year, you know, there was a lot of conversation in the ex-Muslim community about desecrating the Quran and if it's a valid form of protest, and a lot of moral and philosophical arguments about this kind of expression and this kind of protest. And that's something that we fully support at Atheist Republic. We're kind of more provocative than other organizations. And yeah. Armin started the hashtag desecrate the Quran campaign with the idea that if more people do it, it diffuses the risk. But this inadvertently garnered a lot of attention and support from a lot of right-wing Hindu nationalists or Hindutva, who have a disordinate amount of just straight-up anti-Muslim bigotry. Mm-hmm. And that's not something we support, and it's actually something we actively despise. And so, inspired by you, Abdullah, okay, Armin specifically, decided, okay, well, I have to blaspheme against a Hindu goddess now, or a Hindu deity, to show that this form of expression, this form of protest, is not exclusive to a group that these people dislike, right? We're an equal opportunity offender. He tweeted a picture, kind of a pinup style drawing of the Hindu goddess Kali, celebrating her as sexy. And this caused the most torrential storm of abuse that many activists have seen in like over 15 years of activism. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never seen anything like this. And I've been dealing with Islamists for like over a decade. Like, this is crazy. Like, the amount of personal harassment I received was insane, like sexual harassment, rape threats, death threats, just straight up some of the most depraved stuff I've ever seen on the internet, directed at us because of a cartoon and us saying something that I think is a compliment. Like, this is sexy, we're celebrating it. Anyway, so all of that harassment was done in an attempt to silence us, right? Or to shut us down, intimidate us. And that's just not how we roll at Atheist Republic, okay? We don't back down, we double down. So that inspired us to create the Blasphemous Art Project, as we call it, where at least once a week we publish an artwork that is usually a deity of some kind, in a way that could be perceived as blasphemous. And we do it with a couple of reasons. One is to spark conversation around blasphemy, because it's an extremely useful tool to educate people about freedom of expression, I found. I am very passionate about free speech and free expression, mm-hmm. and fighting blasphemy laws. And it gives us an opportunity to teach more people about that and why the freedom to offend is completely, it's an invaluable commodity, is the quote. And it also, this creative medium gives us an opportunity to challenge taboos in other ways. So we're challenging the taboo of blasphemy, and we're also challenging the taboo of sex negativity. Because a lot of the backlash we were getting was specifically because of seeing a sexy woman, mm-hmm. and the hatred of a woman's sexuality. And so this can be in a lot of ways. This could be LGBT acceptance. This could be, I don't know, just a very, there's a great variety of human sexuality in general. So we show that in a lot of different ways. And it also honestly teaches people a lot about different religions. We've done like West African goddesses and Filipino goddesses, mm-hmm. and stuff. And that's taught me a lot. A Japanese goddess. Yeah. So a lot of different deities. And we also just have a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So I do recommend people check that out as well.
I'm going to give you a little teaser right now. This is, mm-hmm. fresh off the press as of literally 3 a.m. this morning. Okay. I haven't even talked about this on our channel. If you're in India, make sure you subscribe to our newsletter. Okay. Because that website may not be around for much longer if you're in India.
Interesting.
There's word on the street.
I was gonna say, like, you guys lost your Twitter accounts because of this.
Yes. Yeah. I've been banned. I'm in Twitter jail. I was never officially notified by Twitter why I was suspended. Armin was suspended ostensibly or for supposed hate speech. But if you actually like look at what was listed in his reasons for suspension, like none of them actually direct like hatred or harassment against any protected group. So it doesn't even fit their own like policy. We've had so many different legal complaints filed against us in India because of this, like 5 or 6, like I've honestly lost track. Our website got blocked by the Ministry of Telecommunications on our main Atheist Republic website on many different internet service providers, not all, but it depends on what region you're in. And we are involved in a case that is going to go before the Supreme Court of India regarding they're using Armin's blasphemy or that specific tweet and some of our art as a reason why they should create further restrictions on social media and set up like this special council run by government officials to help pull down like hate speech faster. I'm like, that doesn't sound authoritarian at all.
It sounds like Pakistan turning into Pakistan. Yeah.
Well, and then we also got our main Facebook page completely banned in India. Mm-hmm. And the only other country to do that to us is Pakistan. And then after that, Armin's personal Facebook page has now been banned in India. He can't even message users in India anymore. So they're taking stronger action against him than Pakistan ever did, or against our organization in general.
We can we can come up with ways to like with the website, there's ways to get around it. With Twitter and with Facebook, there's not much you can do. But my website was blocked in certain places in the world, abdullahsamir.com. Mm. But I just created another website, abdullahsamir.site, and it works. So typically, they just block the domain name. You can just create like a mirror and it works. Like Wiki Islam was blocked in Pakistan. Muhammad Syed made another one called Wiki Islamica. That one works. So sometimes it's just a very lazy way of blocking. I mean, they can do more than that. They can like actually put effort into blocking it, like actually blocking it. And then it would be harder to unblock. But if you guys do get blocked, do reach out to me and I will use my technical wizardry. We both have a good friend as well that supports Atheist Republic. He's one of the subscribers here. I don't know if he wants me to mention his name, but he's a genius. He's a tech whiz.
He's a binary skeptic.
Yes.
Yes. I love him. I love talking to him.
Yes. 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 He's a good buddy of mine too. And we've been talking about like tech stuff recently. I'm job hunting right now. I'm in the middle of some personal decision which way I'm going to be going. So he's amazing. So if you need, there you go. Problem solved. Just talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's done us so many favors. Well, that was actually part of the reason why we started our blasphemousart.com website, because if the reason why we push our newsletter so hard is because we're obviously extremely aware of the fact that, you know, we can be kicked off of someone's platform anytime. Right. So the only platform that we are sure that we can keep for ourselves is our newsletter. And we have a way to sign up for it on atheistrepublic.com/newsletter. But if you're blocked in India from the site, you can instead go to blasphemousart.com/newsletter, or there's pop-ups that will immediately show up to help get you on board, because we can make sure that we can always be in touch with you that way. Do you have a newsletter? I think you do.
I do. I haven't used them. I'm trying to figure out how to use it. I'm not sure what to do right now. Maybe we could talk offline and get some ideas, share some ideas about that. Because I do have one, but it's like I've hit the limit of 1,000 for the free one. And I don't know if I want to pay for it or not. We can talk later. Mm. I do have one, though. I just haven't used it. It's kind of like my last ditch backup in case everything goes to hell. Not actively being used at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. We really like having it because that way we can make sure that we can always reach our audience ourselves and say, this is where you can find us now, you know, if worse comes to worse. Yes. And just also keep people, because our Atheist Republic's community is so huge and diffuse. Well, not diffuse, mm-hmm. but scattered, you know, that it's an easy way for us to make sure that more people are aware of what we're doing in general, because, you know, we have like over almost 2.5 million people on the main Facebook page. We have over 80,000 people in our main international group across all of our other local consulates and topic oriented groups. We maybe have like 150,000, 200,000 people in those groups. And then we have our YouTube community on Instagram, Twitter, and Discord, and our private forum. And so obviously, like, that's a lot of different areas where we have to make sure people are aware of what we're doing. And so having a newsletter to just blast is extremely helpful.
Yeah, it's a great idea. It's a gold standard of keeping in touch with your clients or customers, because obviously Facebook, even if you have a million likes, I mean, who knows how many people they're going to show the content to. That's I don't know if you guys know Dan Broadbent, a science enthusiast. Like, he lost his Facebook page. He has a Facebook page.
Wait, no, you're right. I remember that.
He has this atheist, like, it's beautiful because it's a science page, but like it has this little like atheist things it like puts in there, which is beautiful. It's like the right way to market this stuff, because it's not like, you know, not in your face, atheist, public, blasphemous. It's like, check out the science page. This is nice. And you people are like, oh, this is interesting. And then they get a little bit of like, you know, I like it. I like the style. But of course, even then he's getting like, you know, slapped down by Facebook for no good reason. And this is his livelihood. This is his full-time income. So yeah, it's good that you guys have a site. It's good that you have a newsletter. You know, I fully support you guys on that, and keep up the good work. Is there anything else about your story we didn't cover yet that we want to talk about sexual shame? I think we covered a lot, actually.
I mean, nothing off the top of my head. You know, if people are interested in hearing more about this stuff, I'd encourage them to check out Atheist Republic, specifically an interview I did with the author of this book, Wayward. So maybe look up like Atheist Republic, Alice Gretchen. It's spelled G-R-E-C-Z-Y-N, but it's pronounced Gretchen. Where this book is about her growing up in an evangelical family where like her parents' faith basically compelled them to become homeless and just wander the country. And the deep messages of sexual purity that she got from her upbringing. And so we had an awesome conversation kind of unpacking like our experiences as women in a Christian faith on a more deeper and detailed level, and kind of just like dealing with sexual shame more in general. So if you guys are not from that kind of background, I still think a lot of people could gain something from it. We have a lot of different content just kind of about this issue. And we also just talk about a lot of different stuff on AR. Like, we do the news every week. We do Q&As every week. And a lot of different streams in the past going over like freaking every religion under the sun. And we have a lot of Islam-focused content as well.
So you guys,
of course, because of Armin's background. So
you guys are also Islamophobes. I see.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Okay, I'm going to link the Atheist Republic channel as well. I don't know if I did that already, but yeah, it'll be in the description as well. So that's going to be a wrap. Thank you, Susanna, for joining. It's been a great conversation, long overdue. And thanks for sharing your story. Obviously, you went into a lot of personal detail, and you know that's not easy. Do appreciate it. And yeah, everyone that's here, you know, let's support Atheist Republic. Check out the channel. I know you guys have it much harder. I mean, I thought I had it hard, but you guys have it even harder with the demonetizations and the bans. And
we have governments coming after us.
Oh my God. Yeah, so definitely I encourage everyone to support, you know, sister channel, Atheist Republic, and do check it out. And yeah, like the video and all that stuff. Thanks, everyone. And
wait, there was one thing I wanted to say. Yeah. There was a hilarious comment by someone in the chat.
Yeah, which one?
It was way earlier, but they said, it's so strange to see Susanna not with someone who's yelling all the time.
I'm in. We love Iman.
We do.
Armin was good. I had him recently, and it was like, it was really calm. I was like, oh, this is nice.
He's very well behaved on other people's platforms for the most part.
Yeah, it gets to be free on the main one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but in my house.
I mean. Okay, so yeah, that's a wrap. And thank you everyone for joining. And if you don't know, I have a podcast. So if this is difficult for you to watch on YouTube, although I prefer you watch on YouTube because I want to grow the YouTube channel, there is another way to watch this, listen to this this show, which is on your favorite podcast platform. Look up Friendly Ex-Muslim, and we're on episode 100. So this is a monumental episode, big number.
I know, I feel so honored. What the hell?
Yeah, it's awesome. All right, thanks everyone. And if you didn't like the stream, and subscribe if you're new here, check out Atheist Republic's stream channel and atheistrepublic.com. Sign up for the newsletter, sign up for Blasphemous Art, and see you guys again in a few days for the next live stream. And Abdullah Gondal and I are in chat. We're going to have a stream hopefully maybe tomorrow. We'll see. Soon.
Those are my favorite. Yes. You get the two Abdullahs together, you know it's going to be good. Well, thank you so much for having me, Abdullah. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it was
a pleasure. And guys, make sure to support him on Patreon if you can.
Oh, yeah, as well. If you can do that, that would be appreciated. If you, thank you guys so much. Appreciate it.
Help show him that you want him all the time. You want more of this, okay? But it takes a village to make this happen.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, everyone. Bye for now. And...